just for the members, you've got a calendar of bills that are scheduled for public hearing work session for my fellow Republican members. This is a tentative schedule only, and is subject to change, although it doesn't say tentative. I want to make sure that you understood that. It's just, we're trying to give you a little bit of an understanding of where we are in terms of planning.
How come you're so far ahead? I don't know how I'm like this.
I guess I don't know.
Okay.
What month is this?
August?
This is the current month. Yeah, August, no.
Yeah.
All right.
Jokes, it might come back to haunt us.
So let's do a public hearing on Senate Bill 70, and staff, would you tell us what we have in front of us? Just what's the skinny on this puppy?
Judge.
You can hold a hearing on this?
Well, this is a chameleon bill, I think. This bill started out, if I can find the bill.
Started out as a new judge.
This bill.
Started out as a bill for new judges, and to divide the 18th Judicial District, which contains Tillamook and Clatsop County, into two independent districts. It will be presented to you today as a with a slightly different color. You have in your packet the dash one and the dash two amendments. The dash one amendments include provisions for judicial salaries in sections 1 through 4. Section 5 has a change in judicial retirement, increasing the number of years of service from 218. That's because judges typically serve in 6-year terms. Section 7 adds health insurance for Plan B judges, those are the judges that go into senior status and continue in some service. And Section 9 and the succeeding sections are some housekeeping changes that were proposed by the Judicial Department and were also contained in House Bill 2335. Then you also have the dash two amendments, which are some increases in judicial retirement. And I think that Mr. Linden is here to explain those to the committee.
Okay. Bill Linden? And was Kingsley going to come up?
Harper and I will take yours out of place.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For your record, Bill Linden. Today I'm representing the Circuit Court Judges Association and the Appellate Court Judges Association. Counsel has very adequately described the amendments that we're bringing forward for your consideration. You will note the bill started out as an authorization for new judgeships. Those recommendations came from the Gleaves Committee, which is a committee of lawyers, members of the public, judges, and two legislative representatives who studied new judgeship needs in the interim. There are at least 3 or 4 other bills relating to new judgeships that are filed in the House and the Senate, and I expect that you will be having a discussion on new judgeships at some point. The purposes of this bill, however, we are removing those new judgeship provisions. They were included in the Chief Justice's recommended budget, the funding for them. However, they were not included in the governor's recommendation. There currently is no funding identified for new judgeships. I know that there's some desire to take a serious look at whether money can be found, but it has not been found at this date. The Gleaves Committee did make a presentation to the Public Safety Subcommittee of the Ways and Means Committee on the new judgeship issue, and as I say, there are other vehicles in which that issue will probably be brought in front of you. The dash one amendments to Senate Bill 70, I will run through quickly. You'll note that sections 1 through 4 deal with salary adjustments for judges. You'll also note that we have blanks in the bill in terms of what types of adjustments. Oregon's judges have not received a salary adjustment since July 1 of 1997. Our circuit court judges currently rank 40th out of the 50 states in terms of their compensation, as does our Supreme Court. They're 40th out of 50. Our Court of Appeals judges rank 36th out of the 38 states that have intermediate appellate courts. And those rankings include the statutory salary and the dollar value of the 7% pickup that judges receive on their retirement. So our judiciary has fallen way back in the pack. Again, this is an item that was the Chief Justice recommended funding for. The governor did not include it in his budget. We are hopeful that we may be able to address it in some manner this session. There is not, however, currently funding earmarked or available for this particular need. We do want to have the Ways and Means Committee have an opportunity to put this issue on their long list of things that perhaps are deserving of funding. And so with these amendments and the others I'll describe quickly, our hope is that this bill can go down to the Ways and Means Committee, and we'll see if at some point in the process there's interest and ability to address them. Section 5 of the bill is a small change to the judicial retirement statute. Right now, judges are the only group in state government that have a defined benefit plan, essentially. They earn retirement credits at different rates than regular PERS. They are also capped. Their benefits are capped at 75% of their final average salary. In the first 16 years of service, judges earn 3.75% per year towards their retirement. That is a result of the fact that judges tend to come into public service later in their lives than other public employees. If you've got an experienced attorney, for example, looking at judicial office at age 45 or 50, the accrual rate on the retirement plan for judges needs to result in a faster accrual than if you've got an employee who may be looking at state or local government employment at age 25 to 30. This is a feature of Oregon's plan. It always has been. It's a feature of most judicial retirement plans. Our judges are elected for six-year terms. It makes sense to us to have that accrual rate apply to the first 18 years, and then it drops down to 2%. Those 18 years represent three terms in office. Most judges serve at least those three terms. Judges tend to serve between 15 and 25 years, so it fits in terms of the electoral process we have in place for them. The Section 7 amendment, we do have two retirement plans for judges in Oregon. What we call Plan A is just straight retirement. At the time of retirement, a judge declares they want to be in this Plan A. Their years are multiplied by 2.8125% for the first 16 years and then by 1.67 for service after that. The Plan B retirement, which the legislature adopted in the early 90s, allows for slightly higher retirement benefits in exchange for judges after retirement providing 35 days a year of free service anywhere in the state for 5 years after retirement. It results in a pool of experienced trial judges who the Chief Justice can assign as needed in any district in the state to fill in for judges who may be ill, if there may be a conflict in a particular case, to help out with workload problems, and any reason why the Chief Justice has to plug some extra judicial resource into a district, Plan B gives a very good source for that. The hole in the Plan B program we've had since day one is that while these judges are actively providing the service, we haven't been able to provide them with health insurance coverage, which is an important element of the compensation package that they have had while they've been active full-time judges. This bill, this Section 7, and would allow for the statutory authority for the Judicial Department to provide Plan B judges who are actively serving with insurance coverage. This is not funded in the governor's budget either. But again, it's an issue we would like to get down to the Ways and Means Committee for their consideration in the event that funding were to be available and this were to be identified as a high priority. So those are the three elements of the Dash 1 amendments that relate to judges specifically. The balance of the Dash 1 amendments, as were described by counsel, are primarily housekeeping in nature, and I'll be even briefer in describing those. The Section 9 amendments divide Clatsop and Tillamook County into their own judicial districts. They are currently a single judicial district. Practical terms, they operate as though they were two separate judicial districts. There are some geographic issues there. This simply puts them on the same status as most of the counties. They would be their own separate judicial district administered as the particular local circumstance requires.
So basically, there are four judges now serving the two counties.
Right, and there would be
two and two.
Exactly, two and two.
Anybody getting districted out, so to speak?
No. Absolutely not. And they've always had those two counties have had a good history of covering for each other with their judges, and that will continue.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Harper.
As long as we're on that, how about facilities, court facilities? Will one county have to build a two-judge facility?
Chairman, Senator Harper, it will not involve any facility changes or expenses to anyone. It's really... both counties have their separate facilities right now, and the two judges in each county are resident in those facilities. That doesn't change. I can't imagine there's any cost whatsoever. I'll defer to, and okay. Kingsley agrees.
Thank you.
Section 12 through...
What does Section 10 do?
Oh, I'm sorry. Section 10.
Just a conforming amendment?
Yes, Section 10, Mr. Chairman, Section 10 is a conforming amendment.
Okay.
And Section 11 is an effective date amendment. Those provisions would kick in January 1, 2002.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fire.
Thank you. I guess if it's not going to do anything, then why do it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byer, I didn't describe that as well as I could. What it will do is provide that each county will be administered by the judges who are resident in that county, as opposed to the current system where you have a presiding judge from one of the counties who is resident in one of the counties, who on paper is also the chief administrative officer for the other county. In practice, both counties... tend to their own affairs, so to speak. The day-to-day management is happening in both counties. This would remove any kind of impression that the single presiding judge for that district was in fact really administering the day-to-day affairs of the other county. There's no dispute between the judges. They just think it'd be more efficient to have it set up in this manner. And this has actually been the trend. At one point we had some districts that had 6-8 counties in them, and the administration became pretty cumbersome. So this is where most of the other counties have moved in the last decade, into single district judicial districts.
Further questions?
Well, okay, I guess the next obvious one is, does the additional presiding judge and make more money than the other judge?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byer, not a penny. They do it for the, the pleasure of being in charge, so to speak. Our presiding judges are paid the same salary as all the other judges of the trial courts. I believe it's only the Chief Justice makes...
The Court of Appeals.
The Chief Justice and the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals do make a little bit more than their colleagues, but in the Circuit Court, it's all the same.
Okay. Another question, Senator Harper. Sorry.
I'm sorry. What is the rationale for not doing it for the rest of these multi-county districts where there are, can be evenly split at least?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Harper, the practice has been to let the districts, the judges within those districts decide on their own to make the change. In some districts, they prefer the way it is. Others, as I said, the trend has been to split them out. For example, Klamath and Lake were split out, I think, 4 years ago. That was primarily an issue of geography. Some districts like it the way it is, and I think the Chief Justice's position is to let them sort of make this decision on their own. They're the ones who have to live with it day to day.
Okay. Okay.
Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chair, I just, it's not a requirement. I agree.
I just want to add my support on the judge's salary. I think it's a disgrace, and I realize we're not the Ways and Means Committee, but I think it's disgraceful that my understanding is a young law clerk, a young person just passing the bar and going to probably a major law firm in Portland and will make more than any of the judges. That's pretty sad commentary, and I hate seeing Oregon being at the bottom of the heap each time down in the lower end. I just hate to see that happen. Pardon?
We're only 40th.
Only 40th. Well, I just think we should be doing something with the judges, and I would hope that if it gets to Ways and Means, I certainly will vote to support it.
Do we have a comparison of other states and their judicial salaries?
I have a comparison, yes. What I do not have is enough copies for the committee, but I could certainly provide them.
Maybe we could have somebody make one, I suppose.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a conflict of interest. Some judges are some of my best friends.
Well, I have a conflict, too, because sometimes I have to testify in their courts. But
yeah. I had this.
Maybe that's why I keep losing all these cases.
I had a desk for 10 years. I had to sit across from Judge Ellis and look at him for 10 years. And I'm still supportive of raising his salary.
Okay. Back to the substance of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, sections 12 through, bear with me here, 17 deal with a name change for the what has been called the Supreme Court Library, and then the provisions of this amendment would be changed to the State of Oregon Law Library. In essence, that is what that facility is. It's the law library for the State of Oregon. It's heavily used by the courts, the Department of Justice, public users, State Public Defender's Office. And it would allow that change to be made, and as I understand it, it would also allow for some of the expenses of operating that that facility to be paid by revenue that would come from providing electronic access to the materials in that library. There are law firms and DAs, public defenders, others who want to have access to the electronic records and materials in the law library. There's a way to do that for a cost recovery fee, and this would authorize that revenue from those fees to go towards supporting the facility. Then, Section 18, this would authorize judges to serve as personal representatives. Personal representatives, as you're aware, are appointed when you have usually a family member who is incapacitated and unable to take care of their own affairs. This statute's been around forever, and blanket prohibition on judges acting as personal representatives, which by implication obviously prevents judges from being appointed as a personal representative for a family member, which is usually where, you know, that's when you have a person who needs a representative, it's usually within the family.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
What was the rationale for not allowing judges to be qualified as a personal representative? I mean, they rank right up here with the incompetent, minors, deceased individuals,
hey,
persons who've been disbarred.
You are who you associate with.
We'd like to think that those are not related to the original reasons why judges were put in that category. It was my understanding is there was a belief there was a inherent conflict of interest because judges do eventually have to, they're involved in the resolution of issues related to the person who's got the representative. The Judicial Conduct Code would still limit their participation as personal representatives, but this amendment would permit them to at least be appointed if they so desired. In 95, there were similar prohibitions on judges from acting as guardians or conservators for family members. They were repealed. This one was not repealed at the time, but my recollection is that there was no particular reason why it wasn't repealed. It was just an oversight. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to allow judges to at least legally act as guardians, conservators, or in this case, personal representatives.
How would you handle the conflict of interest issue if there was one?
Well, let's say, for example, we don't have too many of these. Let's say we have a one-judge county, and that judge has been appointed as a personal representative for a family member, and let's say there's a dispute over the management of that family member's estate and assets. You would have to bring a judge in from a neighboring county. They'd do what they call a swap, and you'd have a judge in who did not have any relationship to the family member. That's typically how it's handled.
Right. So generally, they would step aside and let someone else preside over them.
Correct.
Okay. All of my counties, they're related.
Next way,
I was going to say, that's why I live in the northern part of the state, Senator Duncan.
Well, you know, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm wondering how really important that is. I mean, in some respects, I think I understand it. I mean, if I were in a dispute and a judge is the personal representative, and then it goes into another judge, hey, my buddy next door is going to come hear the case. I just see the potential of real conflict of interest, and you'd have certainly advantage over the other the people contesting it. I suppose that would happen with any kind of a legal matter that a judge might have.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, and the actual assignment of the judge to go hear the case is made by the Chief Justice. There's although there may now be in place a blanket order permitting judges to sit from county to county. Is that correct? It isn't necessarily the judge next door who might hear that case. It could be a judge from another district. Their obligation as judges is to impartially adjudicate the fact and the case in front of them. So I don't think that the litigants get the impression that it's a, you know, handoff to my good buddy who's going to do whatever I tell him to do. It really isn't how it works. Section 19 is notice of change of name. This has to do with here's what it provides. I'll be brief. An application for the change of name of a minor child need not be given to a parent of the child if the other parent of the child files a verified statement that asserts the minor child has not resided with the other parent and that the other parent has not contributed or tried to contribute to the support of the child. What this is trying to get at, is situations where you have a parent who is not in the parenting picture, so to speak, and you've got a request to change the name of the child, and the court has to, under current law, go through what is a cumbersome and sometimes costly process of trying to find that other parent, because we're right now, courts are required to notice that parent. This change would simply provide that you don't have to give that notice if the custodial parent is willing to file a statement that says the child has not resided with the other parent and that the other parent has not contributed or attempted to contribute to the support of the child. Section 20 through 22 are simply miscellaneous provisions. Section 20 is a conforming amendment or codifying amendment. The unit captions language, and then the bill does have an effective date of July 1, 2001. So that, in essence, are the gist of the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 70 that we're proposing.
Okay, and who's on the dash two amendments?
The dash two amendments, I'm going to present these as well on behalf of the Circuit Court Judges Association. These amendments relate to judges who have retired under what I referred to earlier as Plan A. These provide an ad hoc retirement increase for those judges. Again, this is not an item that is funded in the Chief Justice's budget or the governor's budget, but at the request of the senior judges, I brought it forward for your consideration.
Okay, again, what do they do?
They would provide an ad hoc, one-time benefit increase for Plan A judges, and these are judges who retired basically before Plan B was available in the early 90s. If they had retired before 1981, there'd be a 15% increase in benefit levels. If they had been retired between 1981 and 1990, 10%, and between 1990 and August 1991, when Plan B became effective, it would be a 5% adjustment. These judges, by and large, retired at about 50% of final average salary under the old formula, and their argument is that they've really lost out in terms of cost of living over the years and are looking for a one-time adjustment. Again, not funded currently, but our hope was to be able to at least get this down to the Ways and Means Committee and see if they had an interest in it.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Duncan.
Not that this should make a difference in the decision, but I'm just curious, how many judges would fall in that category? Living former judges are there?
If I could consult for 1 second here.
2 years ago, there were 52 members.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, 2 years ago there were 52. We think there's probably around 40 to 42 this year.
Down, doesn't it?
Senator Harper.
Would we get anything by this increase? Would they become Category B judges or?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Harper, no. It would not change the retirement plan. It would just simply be an ad hoc benefit increase. So they would not, their base benefits would remain the same. They would not increase.
All right. Any other questions? Bill?
Mr. Chairman, I would just simply add that the salary survey you've received gives you the array of Oregon salaries versus other states. If you go to the end of it, I think it's page 10, it gives you a list of all 50 states in the District of Columbia. These rankings, we look lower in than what I described, and that's because these don't include the 7% pickup. Oregon is one of two states that picks up the retirement costs for their judges. We think you have to add that in there to get a true picture of what their compensation is. That's why this shows, for example, Oregon Supreme Court at 46th in the nation with the 7% at 40th.
All right. Trying to get some bearing on this. Colorado is a similar state in terms of size. Their salaries don't appear to be too much higher than Oregon.
Mr. Chairman, you're absolutely correct. There are some other anomalies in here. I think it's fair to say that Oregon, Colorado, Hawaii, although they've made some progress lately, New Mexico, Wyoming, those judges in those states have fared worse in the last decade in terms of average increases, and each state has its own reasons. For example, in New Mexico, a rather public dispute between the Chief Justice and the Speaker tended to wipe salaries off of their agenda for 4 years. So every state's got its own unique circumstance. If you look at our neighboring states, Washington, for example, their trial court is at 111,000 versus our 85,000. Idaho has moved past us. They're at 92,000. California, we usually don't use as a comparator, but just for your info, 122,000. Nevada, now at 110,000. So the national average is $104,000. I know that is a lot of money, but That 100,000 figure was cracked by most states about 5 or 6 years ago. And as I say, the national average is now well over 100,000 for trial courts.
All right, thank you. Kingsley, are you going to say anything, or are you just backing him up?
For the record, Kingsley Click, State Court Administrator. I was here mainly for questions.
Thank you. Paul Snyder is here to speak. Thank you, Bill.
No, it's no comfort.
Paul.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. My comments, Mr. Chair, would be directed toward the printed bill. If that's not what's under active consideration by the committee, I don't really have anything to say.
That'll be a first.
Well, part of that is an amendment.
Yeah. Have you seen the amendments? Have a chance to look at them?
I just started to go through them, Mr. Chair. They appear to relate primarily to salaries. Right. And we don't, that's not an AOC issue.
Well, the dashboard has that in it.
While you're here, tell us about the additional judge thing. What were you going to say? Testifying the original bill, just briefly. We may see that again somewhere.
It's possible, Mr. Chair. It's possible. We've been working with a number of interested parties, including the judicial branch, over a period of years to address the issue of court facilities. I actually have a tape of a 1981 dialogue between then Representative Courtney and Dennis Bromka, who was the executive director of the Commission on Judicial Branch, when that bill was being proposed to this body for the state takeover of the trial court system. In that discussion, got around to the issue of what are you going to do about court facilities, and Mr. Bromka, I'm paraphrasing, said something along the lines, well, the counties are going to have responsibility for providing the facilities. Senator Courtney expressed surprise with that. Mr. Bromka said basically, look, if any rational person would make this a part of the unified court system if we could do it that way, but right now that's not what can be done. It was an issue of both the various ways that the courts are used. The courthouses are multi-purpose buildings. They involve a whole host of different activities, not just the courts. And the other part of it was the cost. I don't know how to absorb that cost in that particular bill. But the problem continues. As a matter of fact, it's gotten progressively more difficult, both for judges and for county commissioners, because counties have suffered significant issues with respect to Measure 5, Measure 47, Measure 50, the O&C revenue losses, the federal forest revenue losses, all the way around. It's been a growing problem, and of course the courts are growing too. And they have a need for additional court space. The Gleaves Committee has done, from what I can tell, a fine job of identifying based on workload where courts are needed. Unfortunately, that workload need bears no relationship to the availability of space in those particular county courthouses or to the cost of providing the space that's needed in those courthouses. And so the AOC position has developed over the last couple of years to oppose the creation of new judgeships absent some kind of funding mechanism to deal with the cost of providing the facilities for those new judges. And that's the AOC position with respect to new judgeships. Nonetheless, we have been working rather hard to address the question of finding some funding sources to deal with this growing issue. And so has the Judicial Department. And there will be a bill up in House Judiciary next week to deal with that particular issue, and we hope it gets some favorable consideration so that we don't find ourselves in this posture 2 years from now.
Okay, so that is a bigger issue. I know Judge Ellis and I have had conversations about that. So, all right, let's keep it in your bonnets here. Go for some way of fixing it. Senator Courtney, you can chime in here anytime you want to. Any wisdom? No? Okay, no wisdom. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All righty then.
Work sessions.
Yeah. What I want to do... I want to have a little time to digest this Senate Bill 70, if I can. I'm going to close the public hearing on it. And move to... Are we ready on 70? Can we do a work session on Senate Bill 780? Get that one out of the way.
On which one?
780.
Chairman, if there are amendments. This bill allows testimony of a complainant of abuse of an elderly person made by a witness after the commission of the alleged abuse. So this is an exception to the normal rule, that evidentiary rule, that would not allow the admissibility of this evidence. These amendments were put together by Pete Shepherd from the Department of Justice and several district attorneys that consulted on that. And as I understand it, they are primarily technical in nature to clearly effectuate what they were the intent of the original bill. So they're really more clarifying. And Mr. Shepherd is here to explain those if the committee wishes.
All right. Everybody remember this bill, or do we need to have Pete Shepherd come up and re-indoctrinate us? You ready? Everybody's ready?
Chair?
Yes, sir.
I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 780.
All right. Senator Courtney moves adoption of the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 780. Discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Metz.
Does the dash one amendment, which I've seen for the first time here, does that appear to get at the comment that Ms. Svensson provided to us in the packet today in her opposition to the bill as written about the right to cross-examine a witness for those who are elderly? I mean, there's something in this amendment that on first glance may get to that, and I'm just wondering if is that set to address that dispute?
I'm not sure what testimony you're referring
well,
to.
Well, this one right here. Yeah.
Was that handed out today?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. She was here. She's here.
Pete, do you want to come up and have you seen this? Why don't you come and take this copy here and read it real quick? I would, is Ingrid here?
She was
her.
I was going to insult her, but no. Nicely, of course.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepherd. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I had not previously seen Ms. Swenson's memo, nor have I spoken with her about her concerns, so if I can take half a second to look at it.
You bet. Go ahead.
Well, I wouldn't presume to speak for her, but I understand her objection to be a concern that the amendment would undermine in some unconstitutional way, I suppose, the right of a criminal defendant to confront witnesses who are presenting testimony against that person. I think the short answer to that is that the statute that's being amended here has been tested repeatedly and sustained against that very attack. So the policy choice for the committee is not, I think the concern for this committee would not be a concern over the constitutionality of the dash one amendments, but rather over the policy.
Well, I guess I want to direct you, Committee, the last paragraph in the statement says it also treats senior citizens, regardless of their capacity, the same as mm-hmm. children and developmentally disabled adults. Well, I guess I would argue with that, because I think your previous testimony was that if the person was available to testify, they would be called to testify. So you don't forget that the person's competent and willing or capable. You would call them.
I would agree with that. If the declarant is unavailable, then there's a further proceeding to test the reliability of the statements before those statements are admitted.
Right. And that's the same thing as the exemption hearsay rule for children and child abuse cases, if I'm not mistaken.
So procedurally, the observation is, it's true that procedurally, the same process is followed. That much of Ms. Swenson's observation is accurate.
Okay.
Okay. Any further questions? No questions. Any objections? Hearing none.
Okay, I'm going to Senate Bill 780. As amended to the floor of the Senate's recommendation.
The recording moves. Senate Bill 780 to the floor of the Senate as amended to the DuPass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? Very none. So ordered. And who would like to carry this one? Would you? Thank you. Senator Burdick will carry the bill then.
Senator Brown carry the
bill. All righty. Mr. Gillis, what are you here for?
495.
Oh, my bill.
Public hearing.
Senate Bill 495. Judge? Now, you realize I introduced this bill for conversation's sake.
And he's here to converse.
I'm Jim Ellis, and I'm currently the presiding judge of the Circuit Court for Multnomah County.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Duncan.
I don't know if the group is aware that we are now looking at the senior judge in the state of Oregon right now.
The oldest in captivity.
the longest serving judge in the state of Oregon.
We just made it so he didn't have to testify in court.
I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 495, and I've provided written copies of the points I'm going to cover and also a background sheet on our court. And I would start by saying that we're trying to do what this bill requires, even without the bill. I discovered about last June or July that we were falling behind in the processing, particularly of non-criminal traffic cases in our Gresham facility, and it appeared that because we have a single courtroom, we simply couldn't put any more people through that courtroom. And so with the approval of the emergency board, we got enough money to hire an additional pro tem. It took longer than we had hoped to get it started, but we now have a night court session, 4 hours
judges,
a night.
Who is that judge?
What's that?
The judge, the night court judge?
Pro Tem Judge Terry Hannon.
Terry Hannon
is sitting there now.
You know who Terry Hannon is? He was the Democratic candidate on the Democratic side of the very first political campaign I ever got involved in, running against Annette Farmer, who was the incumbent Democrat, and Patrick Gillis and myself on the Republican side. So,
and Mr. Chair,
how time kind of brings people around.
Mr. Chair, he was the treasurer of my first campaign for state superintendent of schools.
I knew he was a liberal.
He also served in the same Army Reserve unit that Senator Duncan and I.
We were all together.
At the same time.
The whole committee.
Judge Terry Hannon.
We'll talk about Pat Gillis.
Go ahead, Judge.
I was concerned that we weren't complying with at least the spirit of the statute, and I think we've provided the history here that 1965 legislative session provided for a fifth district judge for the Multnomah County District and directed that judge sit in Gresham. And about 2 years, 4 years later, I was appointed to that fifth seat. So I had some early experience. The following session, perhaps because the court was dragging its feet a bit in handling cases in Gresham, the legislature required the judge to sit daily in Gresham, or a judge. It doesn't specify a particular one. It just happened that the fifth position was created in order to staff that court. The work of the court has greatly expanded. At the time this bill was originally adopted, there were only about 12,000 people in Gresham. There are now about 90,000. And Eastern County was primarily farm country in those days. Now it is an urban center, one of the fastest growing urban areas in the state. The city of Gresham is the fourth largest city in the state of Oregon, exceeded only by Portland, Salem, and Eugene, and continues to grow at a rapid rate. A part of this that is not in the written materials that I wanted to mention to you, because this, frankly, came as a surprise to me when I got to digging into all the various things for which I'm supposed to be responsible. There's a very substantial volume of cases that come to the Gresham Court from the Portland Police Bureau, and that's because of a statute that gives the defendant the option of the case goes to the Gresham Court if a citation is written east of 122nd, unless the defendant opts to have it heard downtown. And again, you're probably all aware that we've got all kinds of problems with our building downtown, including space. To put this in context, it takes about 50 judicial officers to operate our court every day in about 50 courtrooms in six buildings, and we're about to, if you assist us with the furnishings, open an alternative dispute resolution facility in a seventh building. The limitation we have is that we only have the one courtroom at this time, and I can't speak for the county, but the county is, I don't have to tell you, the counties are all strapped for money and not wildly enthused about building court facilities. We don't make very good tenants, no matter who provides the building, because we don't pay rent.
Yeah. I got some possibly good news for you. Have you spoken with Mayor Roger Bondahar from Fairview?
No,
recently?
No.
I would suggest you. I had a conversation with him probably 2 weeks ago. They run a municipal court out of their city hall, their new city hall building, and I ran the idea of perhaps holding a circuit court in that building. He said he's open to the idea, but obviously would have to have that.
That might be a possibility for us. The original problem with the Gresham Court was it is much more difficult to run courts in multiple locations than in a single location. And at one time, excuse me, with the exception of the juvenile facility, we ran all our courtrooms in the Multnomah County Courthouse. That's simply no longer possible. There isn't enough room there. And so, but it's also become somewhat easier to operate courts at remote locations because of using fax and internet access, document transmission, and that kind of thing. We're not solely dependent on paper files that have to be moved back and forth. But moving jurors is still a somewhat complex thing. But our court is enthusiastically in favor of this, and actually, it's our hope that ultimately, and preferably sooner rather than later, the county would provide a four-courtroom facility in East County, because if we can't occupy it every day, it's simply a matter of time. The rate that part of the county is growing, and since we can't get much more work through our downtown facility, it's got to be someplace. And even if we are able to get a new facility built, that's going to take enough years that by then there'll be enough more population and probably enough more court work that we're going to have to operate in more than one building. I wanted to mention that this, and I mentioned this not necessarily just for your benefit, but so you might repeat it if the subject comes up, that Multnomah County is not trying to do any kind of an end run around the Gleaves Committee report on additional judges, that we see this as a part of that. And actually, I had thought probably if I got into this presiding judge thing on the, with not enough time to prepare, probably should have suggested something along this line at the last legislative session, because then it makes it plain that we have to have the facilities, and it's easier to persuade people when the legislature has directed that if you're going to do this, you have to do it on a scale that you can handle the work. But on the short term, probably the best we can do is one full-time judge and one part-time judge, whether the judge is a pro tem or a regular judge. And the work is now being done by a pro tem judge who is appointed by the Supreme Court, but then hired by the court as a referee.
Senator Harper has a question.
Oh, yes, go ahead.
I'm not that well organized. I wouldn't consider it an interruption. We can't put a regular judge in the position without simply putting a referee in a courtroom downtown. We don't have any spares. But it would be my preference to have a regular judge responsible for the Gresham Court. I don't know how many we could place there, but if I were to have my druthers, we'd have all regular judges and no referees, but that's certainly not an option this session.
But there are probably some attorneys that wouldn't mind practicing in Gresham solely, too, since the City of Portland charges them a fee for doing their filings in the Multnomah County Courthouse, and it's located in the City of Portland.
Yes, that's a somewhat tender subject that I try to avoid. We can stir up enough people in the nature of our work without getting involved in their tax problems. That is a touchy subject.
What's your docketing experience right now? In civil cases, are civil cases moving through the system at a sufficient level, or are you behind substantially?
You mean in the entire court?
Yeah, like how long does it take to get a civil case actually to trial?
Our standard statewide is that we dispose of, it's by percentages, and I can't quote it to you off the top of my head, but what we always shoot for is resolving civil cases within a year of filing. And I think most of the courts, the fair comparison is to compare the larger counties. You can't make a fair comparison with smaller counties because if they get one complex case, their caseload is such that it throws their average off. Their averages fluctuate very substantially year to year. But we do better than the other larger counties in some categories. We don't do quite as well in others, but we're fairly close to the standard in all of them, and compared with metropolitan courts, which is really the more precise comparison across the nation, we're among the fastest in resolving any kind of case. And that's true of courts generally in Oregon, but my impression is that those tend to have more difficulty in staying current. The nature of the work has changed enormously, in that when I came on the circuit court, which was a few years ago, almost 30, most of the cases that were tried were automobile accident cases, and the standing half facetious line was that a short trial took a day and a half and a long trial took 2 days. We try almost no automobile accident cases now, and we have usually, for instance, these asbestos cases that when they're tried, we measure those in weeks, not days. And 12 weeks has been fairly typical, and we have at any one time from 50 to 65 of those cases pending. And that's one of the things I wanted to just remind you, I think you've all heard my song on this probably before, that in many ways the Multnomah County Circuit Court differs from all of the other circuit courts in the state. First, we are the municipal court for the two of the four largest cities. We do all of the work that in Lane County would be done by the Springfield and Eugene municipal courts and that sort of thing across the state, so that part of our caseload is not directly comparable. In addition, in the civil area, because almost half of the lawyers are located, their office, who are in practice, their offices are within a mile or two of our courthouse, the more complex litigation tends to be centered in Multnomah County, even if the subject matter has nothing to do with Multnomah County. And that's why we got all the litigation initially on that CAPES project in Tillamook County, the litigation over the building that furnace or burner to destroy the leaking nerve gas canisters in Umatilla County, and all of the hearing loss cases out of the Huntington Yard of the Union Pacific Railroad. And it's an economical thing probably for the people of Oregon and certainly for those litigants, because a great many of these complex cases involve witnesses and even lawyers coming in from out of state, and they need an airport close at hand and So it, that's probably a desirable thing, but it warps our caseload considerably. We do most of, and we're not unique in that. You have the same thing wherever a state prison is located. Then you have a circuit court that is handling cases that really involve the entire state. That used to be just Marion County, but now we have a lot of prisons, and they all have, for instance, the post-conviction proceedings. So I'm not trying to indicate that somehow it's more important. All I'm suggesting is it's simply different. And this is an example, the requirement that we sit in a city other than the county seat, which was kind of unique. I think we may have one or two more of those provisions, but they're not cities the size of Gresham.
Senator, I want to go to Senator Harper. Did you have a question?
Yeah, too. What did you say when you said you do the municipal court business? You're the city judge also?
Chairman, Senator Harper, those two cities have no municipal court. The law permits, the municipal court of Portland was merged into the circuit court by statute. And there's a statute now that prohibits the city of Portland from, if they can create a municipal court, but it cannot handle traffic matters. But the law permits cities to file cases if they choose to in the circuit court. And the city of Gresham has chosen to do that. They looked at the example of Portland. I had a hand in this, so there's probably some pride of authorship, but there's a good deal of economy for the public in only having a single court in one community. That's how we got started with the city of Portland.
How much does the city pay the state for using our judges?
They don't pay anything, but there's a rather substantial revenue, particularly out of the Portland Municipal Court. This is a somewhat touchy subject with the city because they regard this as a great drain on their finances because of the parking tag revenue. But that's how it's done. The state statutes, as they have for a great many years, divide the revenue from criminal cases and non-criminal violations. Half of it goes to the agency that provides the police officer, and half goes to the governmental agency that provides the court. That used to be a division between county and city, and it's now a division between state and city. And in our case, our court takes in over $2 million a month, none of which is retained by the court, and half of the fine revenue, and the state carries almost all of the expense, and the city gets half of the revenue, and the state general fund gets the other half.
I happen to know what the statutory reference is for that?
For that division? I couldn't tell you off the top of my head. I could perhaps track it down and leave it with your staff. I didn't bring a code with me, but it's
in the Oregon Revised Statute.
Yeah,
right. Okay.
It is. It's much more complicated than that now, because since that statute was adopted, which goes back to before I was first a municipal judge, it's pre-1964. Since then, we've added all the various assessments, and ultimately the unitary assessment, and where those funds go depends on different statutes. It's a very complex statutory scheme, and we've also added the recovery of indigent defense expenses incurred by the state. So it's a fairly complicated thing. I've been asked by the city to break down what they get out of our court, and that's going to take quite a bit of work on the part of our accounting people.
Okay.
But it's a substantial chunk of money. I don't know if that completely answers the question, but to give you the proportion, our court costs the state of Oregon about $1.5 million a month to run, and it takes over $2 million. Takes in over $2 million a month, and I think close to $30 million a year. And a package has been approved by Ways and Means to give us a staff to collect unpaid money, which we've never had, and we're hopeful that that's going to be stepped up.
Remember that discussion?
About $90 million.
Yeah.
Actually, my real question, and I didn't mean to get off. What has been the discussion? You know, in the perfect world, we'd toss a couple more judges out there. But in the interim, asking the county to permanently place a judge in Gresham. We have to prioritize. Everybody's a little short. If there's such a need there, why don't they take one of their judges and move them.
Well, it isn't they, it's me. The presiding judge makes the assignments, and we, as I say...
I found the they.
Yeah, finally.
My life.
As I said, it takes about 50 judges and 50 courtrooms, and we only have 37 judges. We have 37 elected positions, and the rest we fill by... We have 4 or 5 statutorily approved referee positions in juvenile court, and we simply created these other referee positions, and that's why we are so short of... That's one of the principal reasons we're so short of staff in our court administrator's office. We cannibalized our own staff in order to hire people because we simply couldn't operate with the number of judges. But I can certainly assign a regular judge to Gresham, but that just means then we assign a referee to one of the courtrooms of the courthouse. So it's just a balancing thing.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Senator Duncan.
Well, Mr. Chair, and Judge Ellis, my understanding is the allocation, when you have a judge, the staffing goes with it. There's a certain staffing pattern. So with pro tems, you're not getting that. Is that... That's true?
That's right. I think 2 positions were funded by Ways and Means. 2 of our 8 we refer to downtown referees, but that includes the one sits in Gresham, non-juvenile. With, for 2 of them, I think a couple of staff positions were provided because they were specifically budgeted for, or at least money was provided with the understanding that's what it would be used for, but the rest of them have no staff. A regular judge, the tradition has been to provide staffing about 5.3 support staff, not necessarily for that courtroom, but just to add to the total.
Right. So
well, Mr. Chair, that's the concern I have with, I hear from my judge within my county, using the pro tem, but they're not getting the staffing that goes with it. So you're buying, you're taking people from the other judges to help support those other judges, and right now they just feel like the workload is just beyond them at this point.
Yes, Senator Duncan, we've had several occasions in the last 6 months, this has gotten worse because we had to eliminate some positions because we were running out of money for the current biennium, where we've had parties, witnesses, lawyers, a judge, a courtroom, a jury, and we could not try a case for lack of a clerk. We had no one to run the recording equipment or manage the jury, handle the exhibits. We've had that happen more than once. Because we have no spare clerks. If a clerk gets sick, unless we can find something a judge can do without a clerk, and that would not ordinarily include a jury trial, then we simply have to close courtroom.
All right. So you're speaking in favor of this bill?
Very much, very much. I think we're obligated to do it even under the existing law, but this would make crystal clear that we need to, and it might help us in getting attention on this courtroom situation.
All right.
And the... I mentioned that we're not trying to do an end run about, from the Glaives Committee report because I have been accused by some of my colleagues of that. And as far as I'm concerned, this would be an appropriate, consistent with the Glaives Committee. If we get extra judges, this is one of the places that one or more of them should be used.
May I ask, Mr. Chair? May I ask, you're not trying to make an end run, but are you making an end run?
No, not at all. In fact, I don't, while I was in favor of this, I can't recall that the chair and I discussed this before the bill was introduced, but my email immediately got hot on this about from around the rest of the state, what was I up to? So I had to disclaim that I was the source.
You know, Judge, I'm looking at the fiscal on this thing, and they come up with a $1.9 million, actually almost $2 million general fund impact. And they've got the judicial position funding cost at $468,000. It sounds like they're double counting the judge that's supposed to already be there.
I think you would reduce from that the cost of the referee, but since we are furnished no staff for referees...
Well, it's got support staff at $1.2 million. Judicial position itself is...
Yeah, I have to confess that accounting is not my long suit.
No, but that's okay. I'll take this.
The breakdown is on the second page, and fortunately we have an authority here on that sort of thing.
For the record, Kings of Click, State Court Administrator, I have not seen what legislative fiscal sent out, but I do have with me the information that we provided to legislative fiscal. One of the reasons you've probably seen two judicial officers, as Judge Ellis mentioned, there are no judges over there presently. Right now, so there is
statute, even though the statute requires you to have one.
The statute requires, correct, a judge hold court, one judge hold court at least one day a week. Right now, they have a referee, right.
That's the deal. I was thinking it was 5 days a week, one judge, 5 days a
week. No, sir. So right now, they have a referee and a half over there. Both those referees right now are approved pro tem, so they can sit as a judge and authorized to exercise full powers of the state as a judge. That pro tem authority is a temporary authority. It's looked at once every 3 years. It must be up for renewal absent something that would bring them before the fitness and shorten their time.
Okay, no, thank you. I appreciate it. I misread actually the bill, so that makes a little bit more sense.
Okay, and I can explain any other fiscal impacts if you need. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right. Anybody willing to move this to Ways and Means?
Sure.
Sure.
Thank you.
I thought it was so late.
We did a work session.
Senate Bill 495. Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 495 to Ways and Means and do pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 495 to Committee on Ways and Means.
I need a judge. Where's my judge?
I got a comment on that, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Discussion. I just think it's remarkable that that despite all the things in City of Gresham, as was pointed out by Judge Ellis, how it's growing, to have two judges there to cover that huge area probably is not enough. And yet, that whole area is covered by one senator, which just shows you the productivity of different individuals, how impressive that really is.
Actually, what it shows you is how much work the senator has to do.
It shows you why they're not well represented, doesn't it?
Is there any serious discussion? Hearing none. I'm sorry, Senator Beyer.
I was just going to object to the motion.
You're going to object. Senator Beyer then objects to the motion. Show him as a no vote. Any further objections? No, thank you, Senator Beyer.
I've made a vote for this thing.
All righty.
Uh-huh.
And let me see what we got here. Okay, half an hour here. Anybody waiting on 773? Senate Bill 773? No.
Paul, he Snyder raised his hand for that there.
Who did? That, apparently the amendments are not ready on that bill, so we're not going to get to that one.
Didn't like the judge bill because.
All right. Public hearing on Senate Bill 198. Judge Ellis, thank you for coming up, by the way. Appreciate it.
We need some days.
And we have Mr. Radford and Ms. Granger et al. And others, whomever.
You don't want to?
For the committee, this is a bill that was sponsored by Senator Randy Miller.
Which one's young?
Well, thank you for pointing that out.
Which one's young?
198.
This is what you're going to hear is going to be kind of interesting. Senator Miller wants the bill. I think the department will tell you they don't want it or need it. So, Mr. Radford.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't know if you wish to do a staff summary of the bill at all or have a presentation of someone who likes the bill prior to the Department of Justice and Department of Administrative Services.
I don't think anybody who likes the bill signed up.
Okay.
I'll play golf.
Go right ahead.
Certainly. For your record, Kristen Granger, Office of Attorney General Hardy Myers, thank you very much for the opportunity to talk with you a little bit about Senate Bill 198 today. I'll give you a little context. As you may or may not be aware, the Department of Justice does not receive a direct appropriation from the state's general fund for its operations in provision of legal services to state government. Instead, it bills by the hour all state agencies for legal services that are provided. That rate is calculated to cover all the costs of providing those legal services. In the past, we have had a real challenge in our accounts receivable for a variety of reasons, but mostly because of agencies who, for over a dispute over a particular portion of the bill or some other reason, have not been able to pay within 30 days, some within 60 days, and some beyond 90 days. The 1999 legislature authorized the department to take certain steps, including an additional staff person in our administrative services area, to step up our accounts receivables collections, and had also, because of that, the Department of Administrative Services had also started a committee to look at the problems associated with accounts receivables due between agencies. And I'll let Mr. Radford talk a little bit about what that committee has accomplished. But in 1999, for example, February of 1999, we had about $2.4 million in bills that are over 30 days due, and $710,000 that were over 90 days due, 90 days overdue. Because of those, the high number of agencies and the high dollar amounts involved, both the steps implemented by the Department of Administrative Services and by the Department of Justice, we have been able to reduce that significantly. In February 2001, we have reduced the $2.4 million to $1.5 million, which is a 39% increase in our collections. And in those over 90 days due, we have improved by 72% from $710,000 to $200,000. In our budget process, the committee chaired by Senator Miller, a number of steps were taken to further encourage the department to collect accounts receivable that are outstanding, and also to encourage other agencies to pay in a more timely manner. In developing our rate, we had to have enough of our rate generate revenue so that we had a small cushion to cover costs that were not that were incurred that we didn't have enough revenue to pay for because of our collections. And because of steps that we have, that the Ways and Means Committee directed the department to engage in, such as prepayments, like retainer agreements with agencies, and additional accounts receivable activities that we would be engaging in, we were able to reduce our hourly rate by about $5. We believe that the steps that DAS has taken internally, coupled with what the department has been able to achieve through these prepayment agreements or these retainer agreements, that we would request that the committee defer action on this bill and give us this interim to implement these steps to see how they work, and in the carrot stick style interagency dynamics, we would like to try the carrot before we go to the stick of putting in statute payment agreements between agencies.
All right, and just kind of as a conversation with the committee yesterday, I have this same conversation with Ms. Granger outside of the chamber. Subsequently went and spoke with Senator Miller about this issue, because I mean, part of the issue is kind of a discussion between the Ways and Means Committee and this department. And Ms. Granger, you alluded to some of the carrot stick things that have been going on so far. Senator Miller indicated to me that he wanted the bill and he thought that the bill was relevant and didn't do damage to those discussions or that carrot stick thing. In fact, he thought it would be more of an incentive. Can you respond to that at all?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. While I believe that Senator Miller said to me also, if you had the choice of what's the most powerful tool, having a directive from a budget committee, having a rule, or having a statute, I would agree with the senator that his well-intentioned bill is definitely the strongest way to ensure that agencies will pay within 30 days. However, I think stronger and harsher than it needs to be, based on the progress that I tried to demonstrate through my testimony in already having reduced our accounts receivable significantly just through the steps that have been made so far. We would just ask for one more biennium to see if the steps, implemented the way the Ways and Means Committee has directed, were effective in eliminating or significantly reducing further our accounts receivables issues. I also would say that the Ways and Means Committee did direct the department to come back to the emergency board and report about the status of our accounts receivable and the effect the prepayment agreements have had on our ability, on our cash flow problems. So I think that the steps that the subcommittee took in deliberating our budget will mitigate significantly the issue of our accounts receivable.
Senator Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you're doing this already, what's the issue? What am I missing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, or excuse me, Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, pardon me.
Speaking for Senator Miller.
Well, I regret that I lack the authority to speak for Senator Miller on this issue. I believe that he intends to make sure that the department's cash flow problems, which were significant, were met by ensuring in statute that agencies pay on time. And we appreciate the motive behind the bill. But
why is that bad?
Excuse me?
Why is that bad?
Well, I think that what we'd like to do is to see if these administrative remedies do end in the same result. I think it would result, if you pass this bill, in the Department of Justice's payment terms being among the only payment terms in statute. And I think that what we believe, and I think what DASC will testify to, is that it's not necessary to do that to achieve the same results.
Why don't we, I mean, I would agree that all agencies should be under the same, we should be consistent. Would that make everything better?
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, I don't know that it would make any better. I just don't believe it's necessary to put in statute these payment terms. It's obviously...
I mean, I'm sorry, I don't want to be bent, but what difference does it make if it's in a statute or... You're coercing them to pay or what?
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, it also, having it in statute means that there could be legal remedies for not complying. It gives the Attorney General and other state agencies very little, if any, flexibility should they run into some fiscal problem. For example, if you have a small state agency who has one trial that wipes out its budget and has no ability to pay its bills, then they're technically in violation of the law for something that might not necessarily be their fault, for one. And for two, it gives the Attorney General and the agency no flexibility in working out some kind of payment strategy or some other way of dealing with this one-time legal snafu that they have to deal with.
So we need to add to the statute some kind of flexibility into it. That's what you're saying.
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, I can't think of how you could make it more flexible unless you made it, for example, 60 days or have some other kind of softening language. But again, we would
give you the language that my bank gives me when I don't pay my bills on time. We can copy that. The whole rest of the world pays their bills on time, or there's a consequence. Why are state agencies different? You know, I'm not mad at you. Don't try not to. But, I mean, what's the big deal? Let's all pay our bills on time like the rest of the world has to do.
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, I think the Attorney General's office would love it if agencies paid their bills on time.
All right, we're trying to help.
And I appreciate the help. And I think what we're saying here is that a statute may not be necessary to achieve the same result.
Radford, you're from the Department of Administrative Services, right?
Yes, sir.
So you have the answers to all of this.
Chair Minnison, members of the committee, my name is John Radford. I'm State Controller representing the State Controller's Division, Department of Administrative Services. I guess I'm here in opposition to the bill, and I think for the basic reasons that have been articulated by Kristen. When we first got involved and became aware of some accounts receivable issues on a statewide basis, both with respect to external customers and internal customers, we put a resource on this. We have one person dedicated to accounts receivable statewide management. We created an accounts receivable core committee to take a look at the statewide problems associated with debt collection. We've worked with a number of almost all of the principal agencies involved. We've worked with external debt collection groups. And we've also took a look at the same time, interagency payments. And at about the same time we were taking a look at that, DOJ raised the issue with us with respect to their cash flow problems, their challenges that they faced in maintaining a working capital balance. And we took a look at the data that they put together from our accounts receivables data and agreed with them that we need to do a better job interagency receivable payments. if you look at the, if you hold DOJ aside and you look at all of the other central agencies that are billing, I would characterize their problem as moderate to slight. And I think the reason that we have such a focus on DOJ is because DOJ is a large legal entity dealing with a huge volume of legal matters and issues that support a lot of detail behind the invoice that an agency receives. Now, we ask the agencies not to pay bills until statutory requirements are met with respect to those bills, and they have to make sure that services are due and owing to the state, that is valid, payable, and they go through an extensive process. With our larger agencies that have a volume of detail to go through, it takes them some time to divide the bill up, get it out to the agencies, the principals that are involved in this, review the bill, and make the answer, you know, make the determination that this, these are in fact valid claims against the agency. And so they've been kind of working under that process for many, many years. When we took a look at the degree to which we have problems exceeding 30 days, 60 days, and 90 days, we partnered with those agencies and with DOJ to come up with some policies and process and procedure changes. We agree, and we put in policy a requirement for agencies to pay the bills within 30 days. We have somewhat of a progressive discipline approach when we have problems identified with those agencies. We have set up a hearings panel process that would provide agencies some due process when there is a dispute on a bill. We don't necessarily believe that that the decision or the determination of that resides entirely with the Department of Justice. It does provide some due process in this, and the decision would be binding. And so we think that the administrative processes that we have built into the system. Also, I would add that we work with the Department of Justice during their Ways and Means process, and are fully committed to implementing the budget notes. I was a little bit surprised to see something like this in statute at this point, frankly. But we are committed, Mike Greenfield is committed, and our office is committed to work with the Department of Justice and with the state agencies to eradicate this problem.
Yes, Senator Harper, Senator Beyer, and Senator Duncan.
Do you charge interest?
That is part of the policy that we have in place to provide those central agencies that are billing the ability to levy fines and fees for late payments, also interest, add interest to the charges.
Do you do that, not the ability to? And what is the charge?
Chairman Minnison, Senator Harper, I'm not aware of right now any agency that is assessing an interest charge on late bills, say, over 30 days.
Why not?
That would be a statutory, or they would be required to use a rate of interest that represents the short-term pool interest rate or an 8%. And this policy that we have gives them the authority to implement that.
But you don't do
that. We don't have that right now. We don't have any agency that I'm aware of, central billing agency that I'm aware of, charging interest. But we would have that ability under the proposed policy. Agencies would have that discretionary authority to implement that.
All right, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me you said that in order to implement this policy, you had to hire an extra person plus put on a committee to oversee what this extra person is doing. It seems to me that this statute would pretty much take care of it rather than having committees talk about it and hiring people to do it. We just told them to do it in law, then they'd have to do it.
Senator Beyer and Chair Minnis, members of the committee, about a year or so ago when we got involved with more of the statewide accounts receivable issues, we carry on the books of our financial statements about $5 billion in receivables, about $2.5 billion represent those receivables that are subject to collections. And we it does require a full-time person to manage the relationships between us and the agencies and the debtors out there and develop policies, follow up with some reporting requirements that are now required to annually report to legislative fiscal office. There's a lot of of energy focus, management, leadership, and control that we provide statewide to those agencies that are engaged in accounts, all types of accounts receivable transactions. The interagency receivables, of course, is a lot smaller portion of that. And we have created an interagency receivable committee to address those policy issues and work at those improvements from a grassroots basis.
Chair, follow up.
Follow up.
Who's on this committee?
The committee is chaired by our Chair Minnison, Senator Beyer. The committee is chaired by a staff person that is our statewide accounts receivable coordinator. We have the principal agencies involved. DAS has a representative on there, Employment Department, Department of Revenue, State System of Higher Education, a number of agencies that have large accounts receivable, interagency receivable balances.
So we've got a whole bunch of government people sitting on a committee now to figure out how to collect money?
From themselves.
Yeah.
Who said it was easy? Senator
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not excited about this bill, but I'm just curious about one thing. You do have agencies that don't come under the jurisdiction of DAS, and I'm thinking of those under state elected officials and so forth. Is there a problem that you know of in those particular areas?
Chair Minnison, Senator Duncan, no, sir. We've had excellent cooperation with all agencies. I really think that we have committed people on these committees and who are responsible for their accounts receivable interagency billings. They have some problems. It could be that they're understaffed. It could be that there's a temporary workload that causes a problem for them. It could be a temporary cash flow problem that they're experiencing. As I mentioned before, the Department of Justice billings can be overwhelming in terms of the detail and the complexity. And we're trying to work with the agencies, for example, to say to them, if you follow a process and a procedure, when you get the invoice, just pay it. Just pay it within 30 days. You can work after the fact on determining what the anomalies are and what the potential disputes are after the fact and make adjustments on the following month's billing. And so we're trying to, it's an educational component as well. We're trying to give them some options to other policies and procedures that they can follow to eliminate the problem for the Department of Justice.
Yeah, just see, Mr. Chair, the last thing we need is another law. I mean, we won't put more laws on the books. I just can't see that.
Well, this whole issue arose as a discussion of Ways and Means because the Department of Justice was having cash flow problems. Yes, no, maybe. Is that what happened?
Mr. Chair, yes. The hourly billing rate is calculated to cover the cost of providing the service, and that would include covering the cost of our cash flow problems when agencies don't pay their bills on time. The rate included a $5 increase to cover that very issue. And through the prepayment retainer portion of our budget and the other steps implemented by the Department of Administrative Services, Chair Miller was able to cut $5 of our rate, that $5 out, because that cushion would not be necessary.
Your budget had assumed a $5 increase because of the cash flow problem. Senator Miller said, no, we're not going to do that. Let's accelerate your payments to your agency so you don't have to do that, correct?
Mr. Chair, that's substantially correct. What we did is enter into, with some of our largest users, prepayment agreements. And with those prepayments, that solves the cushion, the cash necessary to cover the cost of agencies who don't pay on time. And then simultaneously with that, the committee directed the DAS and the Department of Justice to, and specifically the language is, Department of Justice, DAS, and the Treasurer of the State are directed to work together during the 2001-2003 interim to develop and implement a plan to eliminate receivables older than 30 days.
Okay. So you've come up with this process by which you're accelerating payment. Why don't we get amendments to the bill and write that in the bill? And here's the problem. We've been admonished to not depend on budget notes to inspire agencies to do what we'd like them to do. Because unfortunately, in this particular legislative session, which is my eighth, we're receiving information from agency directors and others, which is different from previous sessions where agency directors are telling us, no, we're not going to give you that information because we don't have to, because we don't work for you.
So that's a substantial change in attitude and perception and perspective on the part of people who run the executive branch of government and its attitude towards the legislative assembly. So that's part of, I think, the underlying theme going on in this building. Mr. Radford.
Chair, members of the committee, I will testify that that's not the case in the Department of Administrative Services, and in particularly my knowledge of this bill, with a very solid direction from Mr. Greenfield to implement the budget note and take that very seriously.
I think Mr. Greenfield's been in a number of conversations with respect to some of the attitudes of some of the agency directors with respect to this legislature. Go ahead.
That's good. Mr. Chair, thank you. I want to follow up on something Senator Harper brought up. As I look at this bill with the demand for the 30-day payment, I don't see an enforcement mechanism in this either in terms of, you know, if they don't, there'll be so much accrued interest. Like in our visa statements, it says how much you're going to have to pay. Is that implied somewhere else? Is there an authority, if this is not met under this provision, to charge late fees or whatever, or does it have to be in here? Because I don't see an enforcement mechanism.
Explain
that to me.
Chair Minnison, Senator Metzger, the members of the committee, we are intending to carry out the provisions of the budget note. And whatever enforcement mechanisms that we have at our disposal in DASC will be applied to ensure that the agencies are paying their bills within 30 days. Informally, we've had discussions internally that I'll if we have a problem, we work very closely with the Department of Justice Fiscal Office. If I have a problem with an agency, if I'm notified by the DOJ for a problem with an agency, I will call the fiscal officer and request immediate payment. Secondly, if that's not accomplished, then I would strongly suggest that Mike Greenfield will be having a discussion with the agency director for lack of payment. And in the end, if I have to, I can go in and move the money myself.
Okay, I don't know that you answered my question. I just want to, and if I didn't hear it right, I apologize. My question is, do you already have authority for anybody who's late payment to charge penalties and interest? That's the first question. That's the basic thrust of it right now. Do you have that authority to do that? If Dogambi's 35 days late on our 30-day bill, can you say you got to pay us $8?
Chair Minnison, Senator Metzger, we're in the process of developing that policy right now, and that's a question that we'll have to get back to.
That's not the policy. Do you have the authority to do that?
Well, the answer to that question is I'm just not sure at this point.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Senator Duncan, first of all? It does seem like the answer might be no, but the other thing is, I'm just throwing out for discussion, Senator Bennett, if someone were to move forward with this, is that if, in fact, you had something like this in statute, if the committee ended up going that direction, and placing maybe even specific penalties. I know if we don't pay people, for example, federal retirees, we're paying them 9%. It's in statute. You're going to get this. And there's certainly someone make the case there's an incentive if an agency is more than 30 days late that they will start accruing penalties, which goes against their budget. So that might also be an incentive to be paying on time. But it sounds to me like maybe there's a question as to whether they have the authority to do it, much less a requirement to do it. And I think those incentives, as Senator Harper was mentioning, you know, might be important whether it's done legislatively or not. Thank you.
I think those are good comments. Senator Duncan?
Mr. Chair, I missed the first part of his question, but I guess the question, we're talking about agency to agency, right? None of this deals with any outside deals.
Chair Minnis and Senator Duncan, yes, we're talking about interagency billing,
right.
Billings
just
for motor pools, billings for state
right.
printing, billings
right.
for
right.
assessed
right.
DAS assessments.
I
understand that. Mr. Radford, could you do me a favor and find out whether or not you do have the authority to charge interest to delinquent
right.
accounts and or develop rules to define a delinquent account for interagency?
Mm-hmm. Chair Minnis, I'll get back to you on that for sure. We do have a statute in place that it's modeled after the prompt payment federal law, which requires payments within 45 days, and I believe there is a provision there that allows for the accumulation of interest beyond 45 days.
All right.
But we'll find out and get back to this committee.
I appreciate that. All right, thank you very much. Any other business before the committee?
Anything
not. Thank you, Kristen. It's a good truth.